Stargate Voyager.
I think we're looking again at a lost technology. And it was this ancient apocalypse, 12,800 years ago, that wiped that from the human memory banks.
Why were these ancient elongated skulled peoples or humanoids of Malta living underground?
Now I believe we're talking prior to 9700 BC for the original construction of the Sphinx.
And they were what some people have called giants, probably no more than 7 to 8 feet tall. And those giants have been pulled out of American mounds.
Whether it's the colossal statue heads that have been unearthed, to all the strange artifacts you've been showing in the museums, to some of the strange features they seem to possess, the more I learn about the Olmec culture, really the more fascinated I become. Well, I am very excited to be joined by my friend, Mohammed Ibrahim, one of the world's renowned Egyptian tour guides. He's also an Egyptologist and now the author of the great book, Egypt Before Written History, and I just finished it. Mohammed, thank you for joining me today.
Hi, Derek. The pleasure is mine.
Thank you for making the time. I know you are on tour right now with a group. Yes. What's it like being an author now since your book was released just a month or so ago?
Truly, I found that it is very difficult to gather so much information from different aspects about ancient Egypt. You need to read like maybe 200 books in order to make it just one book. So it's a difficult job, but I enjoy doing the job.
Well, I'm really glad you wrote the book because I'm going to use it often as a source and a reference for all the work I do and the videos I make. And it's one thing to go on tour with you and I'm constantly taking videos of everything you're saying, but then I have to rewatch it and take notes. So this is a whole lot easier just pulling out the book. So it's so great to be with Mohammed Ibrahim, again, author of the new book, Egypt Before the Written History. And I like the subtitle, The Lost Knowledge of Ancient Egypt. Such a great title. So Mohammed, you know, you're this renowned tour guide in Egypt. You're also an Egyptologist. But now you're the author of this book that's really breaking with the mainstream narrative, like it says, revealing the lost knowledge of ancient Egypt. Have you found any opposition since this book came out against in the Egyptological world?
No, I didn't. And by the way, so many of my colleagues and the people who work in the same field, and they still strongly believe in the mainstream stories. Many of them, they had the chance to read the book, and they enjoyed the book because I presented so many evidence in this book, and I took the flow of this subject slowly, step by step, building a good idea about pre-Diluvian Egypt and about the challenges to build these huge structures and the function. So I think anyone from the mainstream and from the people who didn't have any idea about such information, I think they will enjoy reading the book, and it will be very convincing for them.
Yeah, that's one thing I noticed in reading the book was that you started kind of at the beginning and did a nice slow progression through dynastic Egypt to a point where I was almost thinking, man, have they changed Muhammad's mind? As you were referencing, Khufu and Khafre and how, you know, the mainstream credits them with building the pyramids, right? But then you start getting to the middle of the book and towards the end, and that's where you give all the evidence of lost ancient technology, from the statues to the drill holes to the precision cuts. So you really made a case, and I can see how that would be effective in maybe opening the minds of some in the Egyptological community. So congratulations on the book success. And again, if you haven't gotten it, you can buy it on Amazon, Egypt Before the Written History, The Lost Knowledge of Ancient Egypt by Mohammed Ibrahim. Great book, especially, boy, that second half was my favorite. So much I want to ask you about, Mohammed, and in a little bit I'll give a plug for our upcoming Egypt tour. this May. We got a few spots left, and Muhammad is going to be our guide, so you don't want to miss the details on that. First, Muhammad, I wanted to ask you, I saw some photographs coming out the last couple days of a possible new discovery in Egypt of like a 60-ton box. Do you know anything about that? What can you tell us?
The information is still very limited, but this box is unique because of, number one, the location. This is North Egypt. And for the first time, we find such huge objects at North Egypt. By the way, there are so many objects and buildings are in North Egypt, but all of them are buried under hundreds of tons of mud and houses and green land. So I can tell you all what you know about ancient Egypt, all the sites, like in, from Cairo and all the way south, are maybe 10% of what exists in North Egypt. But it is very difficult to find them in North Egypt because of the population. More than 50% of the population of Egypt at that north part, the delta. And as I told you, the mud, the green land, the houses. So we were lucky that they were building a hospital and they were digging to do the foundation of the hospital. So they found this huge box. And I think this is the beginning of this is the beginning of a great discovery. This is just the seed. So they are going to find many. But what is so special about this box? Number one is the size. The pictures don't show much the material, but I think it is limestone, which is another big question. Limestone with this size is not something easy to be done, even when we talk about high technology. And the two knobs, which some, most of the cases, it was from the narrow sides, the front and the back. But this time from the wide side, okay, which is weird. This is, I think, maybe the first example we have for such a statue, for such a box, that the two knobs are from the sideway, not the front or the back side.
And it looks to be about maybe the similar size to the boxes we see in the Serapeum, correct?
Yes, very close.
Exciting. It's always exciting to see a photo of something being just pulled out of the earth. So we'll definitely look more into that. I'm really excited about the next hour with Muhammad because we're going to get into the ancient knowledge of Egypt, ancient technology. I'm going to ask him about stargates. I'm going to get more into the Serapeum. I'm going to ask him about the Sphinx and these precision obelisks. And if we have time, I might even ask him about the Ark of the Covenant, possibly hidden somewhere in Egypt, which is one of my favorite things to ask Muhammad. So, Muhammad, in your book, you talk a lot about the origins of ancient Egypt and Zeptepi. And could you just take a few moments for those who might not be familiar and talk to us about what the word Kemet means and how this is likely the original name for ancient Egypt.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
That's true. All the Egyptian texts are talking about several names of ancient Egypt, and I bought the most famous titles for Egypt. But the most famous one, or what I can call it, the official name for ancient Egypt, is the word or the title Kemet. Kemet came from an Egyptian word Kem, and Kem means black. But this is not fair when you talk about ancient Egypt. Any subject or any topic or any building or anything about ancient Egypt, when you just take one layer of explanation or understanding, that is not fair. You must understand the multiple layers of the Egyptian vocabulary and the Egyptian symbols, because the ancient Egyptian language is one of the richest, if not the most, the richest one in meanings. So sometimes one symbol, one different direction of the symbol can give us different meaning. So Kim doesn't mean only black. It means black land. And when we talk about black land, we talk about the material itself. We don't talk about the color. Black land means mud. And that's why there is another name for Egypt is Deshret, the red land, the desert. Okay? So some people, they take this as an excuse and they say, Kemet, the land of the black people. No, this is not fair, because if we say Deshret, the desert or the red land, so it will be the land of the red people. Okay? But here, they are not talking about the people. They are talking about the land itself. They are talking about the this black color of our soil alongside the River Nile and north of Cairo, the wide delta. And also, they don't talk about the land itself. They talk about the fertility of the land. They talk about the amount of minerals and, if I can call it, vitamins on our land. So I was talking in the book about how many minerals, and some of these minerals are very, very special minerals like gold, silver, some regular minerals like lead, iron, copper, and some radioactive minerals like cobalt, iridium. So these minerals were the reason of the richness and the fertility of the black land in Egypt. And that is why the Greeks, when they invaded Egypt, and they found that the Egyptian, the Kemetian, or the people of Kemet, they practice a kind of science they don't know what it is. Okay? So, in a way to give it a name, they call it the Egyptian science, the chemistry. And the Arabs call it the alchemy, alchemia. This, if I give it the proper interpretation, it means the science of Kemet, or the Egyptian, or the science of the Egyptian people. And what is chemistry? This is what we are talking about, chemistry, these substances that they found in the Egyptian soil.
On that note of chemistry, in the latter half of your book, you were talking about Aswan in the quarry there. And you quote, you talk about how your friend Timothy Hogan suggested that the ancient Egyptians poured hydrofluoric acid above the stone, and then it melted the stone fabric, and this is how they scooped sections out of it. Do you feel like that's part of the chemistry too that you're referencing?
Of course. Okay. You'll find that I don't have any problem to present ideas. Okay. Either I like or I don't like. But I'm trying to put in front of the people who are reading the book many point of views, because if these opinions don't make sense, at least they know what are the kind of theories they must escape, and the other theories it makes sense, so they will bless me, dig more and try to do more work to find the truth and to find out if these theories are right or wrong. So the idea of hydrofluoric acid, I see it very good theory about the explaining the scoop mark. And for the people who don't know, when you see the unfinished obelisk in Aswan at the quarry still there, you see the scoop mark as if they were scooping ice cream or soft cheese. So maybe this idea, using the hydrofluoric acid to soften the layers or the surfaces of the granite, I see it as a good idea. And in my opinion, it makes sense because it matches the tool mark we see at the quarry.
Right. It's so interesting to see these massive obelisks in this quarry that are unfinished. And like you said, it's like there's ice cream scoops out of the top of them and even, you know, around every side about 1 meter long. And yet this is rose granite. This is some of the hardest stone. Like you say, it's full of quartzite, yet they were scooping it like butter. Insane to think about. I want to come back to the unfinished obelisks. But first I want to ask you, we're going to kind of jump all over here today. On our last tour, I remember it was our final last full day where you saved the best for last, and we were going to go inside the Great Pyramid for the private visit, right? The grand finale. And for some reason, we had to wait on the bus, I think maybe about 20 minutes to get in. So we were just kind of killing some time. And in the bus, you were sharing with us stories that you've heard or you've read about some of the healing properties inside the Great Pyramids. And you were talking about even cats that they had found in the Great Pyramids that had died, yet their bodies didn't decompose. Tell us more about that and anything you know about this, because I've been meaning to ask you ever since.
Okay. I don't remember what age I was. I would like maybe 14 years old. My school took us to the book fair. That was in East Cairo. I was walking and wandering around the sections, and there were many books, thousands of books. But then I was attracted to a book written by an Egyptian journalist called Anis Mansour. And this book was, the title of the book, as I remember, The Secrets of the Great Pyramid.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And I started to read the book. And I believe I finished the book even before I went back to my house. So only the 1 hour driving back to my house, I finished the book. And in the book, they were talking about some strange phenomena happening inside the Great Pyramid, inside this room, the so-called King's Room. Because there are two more rooms. One, they call it the Queen's, and the other one, the subterranean under the pyramid. But the stories were about this room, and this room is full of granite, built entirely from inside with granite. He didn't mention, the author in the book, that this information, granite, I know because that is now my field. So granite, especially rose granite, contains between 20 and 60% of quartz. Okay, so I think this is the reason. So what I read in the book and attracted my attention the most, that so many travelers over ages, they discovered that nothing go bad inside the pyramid. Nothing decay inside the pyramid. And he mentioned that some of the tourists in the end of 19th century and beginning of the 20th century, they were escorted by local tour guides inside the Great Pyramid. And they found some dead cats. So they made a point like, what happened and why don't remove these cats? And from the condition of the cat, it seems like the cat died maybe a night before they get in. Still, in good shape. But they were surprised that the local guides told them, no, these cats died a long time ago. Some cats died a year ago and 2 years ago. And some in different condition became like a mummy style, but still no smell, still no decay at all. So they started to do some experiments, other researchers. They found that everything was moisture, like skin, like beef or chicken, fish, it changes to become dry, but never decay. Also, polluted water with some minerals like lead, it becomes clear after 3 nights. Some wounds and some skin stains or like these kind of red dots above the skin, It heals inside the pyramid if you stay 3 days there, and especially if you use this purified water inside the pyramid. And one of the latest research about the pyramid and this room, it talks about how the energy inside this room affects the human brain, which stops creating new cells from the age of 13 or 14 years old. From day one as a baby till 13 years old, any damaged cell in your body creates a new one. And the brain, the same. It does the same thing. Okay? But inside the Great Pyramid, the brain, it starts to do this again.
So you call your tour company Saba Tours. And I want you to tell my viewers, listeners, what Saba means, basically in English, and why this word, how this word is found all over Egypt.
I think that was 9 years ago when I saw in one of the temples, City First Temple in Abydos, I saw a symbol, Saba, and the word Saba means a star. But I saw next to this symbol, another symbol is a gate, that vertical gate, like a door, but it is not regular door. So I started to think, I know the word Saba, and I studied the word Saba, sometimes as a full word, and sometimes adjusted the symbol star. So I checked the dictionary, and I found that the dictionary is saying that the word without the gate, it is Saba, and with the gate, it is also Saba. So what is the meaning with the gate? They still call it star. But I found, no, this is wrong, because I found that the symbol gate by itself is called gate, ruti. This is the Egyptian word, okay? So I found that something is wrong here. The translation of this symbol is not correct. But because I started to pay attention to the symbol, my eyes started to track the symbol in many writings. And I found that they truly talk about stargates, because later I found different styles of this word. The second word I found, great stargate. And then I found stargates. The word gate here is plural. And then I found stars gate. And I started to see different types of the combination of the stars and the gate. And then I found in Dendera Temple many, many stargates. And instead of putting the word star next to the gate, now they brought or they made the gate and punch of the stars above the gate. And in the text above this picture, they wrote the word Saba again, as if they want to tell us that the below symbol is stargate. And inside each gate, there is different symbol each time. So as if they want to say that this is a different star system. And I didn't find any of these symbols having the same number of stars. No, they were all including different numbers. Some were 8, some 10, some 13. Or one includes 8, 10, 13, 15 stars. So I became very confident that the way I translate this word as stargate is the most accurate way. It is not just a star, because if it is just a star, it will be Saba without the symbol gate. But adding the symbol gate, it is very clear. And sometimes they do it in the short style that it is just a star above the gate. So this is very clear. This is a stargate, because in another text, when they want to talk about the star as a star, they draw just a star. They never bring draw the star and the gate. But when they want to talk about the stargate, they put the symbol star and the symbol gate together.
If we consider that these great pyramids were built a minimum of 9,700 BC, like you kind of talk about in your book, that they predate the dynastic Egyptians who existed, 5,000 BC. You talk about how these pyramids likely collected cosmic waves and that they were repurposed by these dynastic Egyptians, Khufu, Khafre, King Tut, all these guys that came along later. And so they saw these pyramids and they thought of them as the greatest structures on earth and obviously wanted to be buried inside of them. I think you talk about how the dynastic Egyptian kings and pharaohs wanted to be buried inside the pyramid because they thought they would receive energy from it and that this would allow them to cross through portals like a ticket into the afterlife to explore other dimensions. Is that what they mean by Stargate? And is that why the dynastics wrote Stargate everywhere?
As I told earlier, when we talk about ancient Egypt, we talk about layers. Okay. So it won't be right to talk about just one layer and stop at this meaning. So when they talk about Stargate, okay, and this written symbol, and by the way, we find that this symbol was written next to some names as a title for the king, but not for all the kings, only five kings. So as if these kings were the people who had the knowledge of the Stargate, either how to activate the Stargate or how to cross or how to deal with the Stargate. Okay. Second thing, I talked about the Stargate and the portal, okay? As if there are two types of gates. One will take you to a star constellation, and the other one will take you to many locations like a place on Earth, a place outside Earth, a place on the moon. So my opinion, the word portal is the big term for the word Stargate. So portal includes Stargate. So yes, the dynastic Egyptians, and I must be fair saying this, that we shall not underestimate the knowledge of dynastic Egypt, 3000 BC and onward, okay? They must found some of the very ancient technology, and they must develop some techniques. Yes, not they didn't reach the same level like the advanced civilizations, the flood and the solar event 10,500 BC, but they must have maybe some access, or they found some maybe objects or some written secrets. Okay, that's why they understood that many of these huge constructions, like the pyramids and some temples, are doing this purpose, are a way to connect with something they don't know, either other dimensions or stars, because you will find that most of the Egyptian buildings, especially the megalithic building, are aligned with different stars, either the sunrise, like Karnak Temple, 21st of December, or the three pyramids of Giza with Orion Belt, or other buildings with Sirius star. So as if it is very clear, they are trying to tell us that these buildings are following or absorbing the stars, like Isis Temple. Isis Temple was one of the main functions is to watch and to report about the rising of Sirius star. Okay, so you see, if you put all this information together, you will find that yes, they understood, and these places were designed at least as one of the function of them is to deal with the knowledge of the stars. So that's why they reused these places as temples or as tombs, but not it was because a big fancy building they want to be buried in. No, because they wanted to give themselves the chance to have another life or another experience, maybe. Okay, so they were waiting for something. They said, okay, I want to be buried there to find something, or something can happen. Okay, maybe it didn't happen, but that was the target, because they understood that these buildings one day were so special. They were not just solid buildings.
You refer to the lost civilization that likely built these pyramids that predated the dynastic Egyptians as the Prediluvians. Do you believe that these Prediluvians actually physically might have passed through Stargates into other dimensions?
Okay, my next book is called Stargates of Ancient Egypt. Okay, and you will find in this book the number, I tracked the title Stargate in many, many temples now. And myself, I was surprised to see that there are so many. And not only this, but also I saw hundreds of old pottery jars from what we call it pre-dynastic, 4,000 BC, 5,000 BC, and 6,000 BC. In these pottery jars, there are also some strange paintings, mainly spirals. And I think they were talking also about kind of portals or stargates. Some other designs, like in Karnak Temple, there is the Chapel of Seven Gates. So there are so many things. It is not just one symbol says Stargate. No, there are so many examples, different styles, but all of them lead to this fact. Also, some kind of paintings in some caves, like we have a cave in far southwest of Egypt. And the cave is talking about the swimmers, and they have different, like something like modern swimsuits and oxygen masks. And when we talk about these pottery jars, as if the same people, the same idea that these people may be either oral tradition they were sharing, or they found some things active during their time. And they wanted to send us the message that there was something weird was going on.
Let's talk for a minute about the timelines of ancient Egypt. In your book, one of the things I really liked was you kind of share the mainstream narrative of pyramid building. And, you know, you talk about the different dynasties. You got the, you know, the Old Kingdom, the Middle Kingdom, the New Kingdom. So the mainstream narrative says that the greatest of all pyramids, the Great Pyramids, were constructed, I believe, in the fourth dynasty, correct?
Yes.
Yet, if you look at the timeline of the dynasties, the Old Kingdom, which came, you know, right after the pre-dynastic era, which was, you know, archaic, why did the Old Kingdom build the best pyramids and then they got worse as time went on? That doesn't seem to make sense. Tell us a little bit about that.
Exactly. When you read the story of the building's evolution, it doesn't make sense at all. How? We talk about dynasty one, or let's say pre-dynastic first. Pre-dynastic, we all agree that they were using very primitive techniques, and they didn't develop any tools, even the pottery wheel. The pottery wheel was developed or was started to be used in Dynasty 2, okay? So imagine pre-dynastic primitive techniques, Dynasty 1, Dynasty 2, also primitive techniques. And when we talk about tombs and what they call it mastaba tomb, they built one mastaba, one layer. And then suddenly at Dynasty 3, they developed a pyramid. They call it the step pyramid, six mastabas. So from 1 to 6, there is no 2, 3, 4, 5, okay? But that can be called like a step, giant step maybe in evolution. But what is very like outside the common sense, that from these slowly steps of evolution, then you find that in Dynasty 4, they gave us the best example of pyramids, okay? As if this kind of giant step, it was like super giant step. But you know, this can be, of course, this is not correct, but if we pretend that this is accepted, the evolution must keep going, okay? If it is not for more, at least the same level. But you find that the curve went down in Dynasty 5 and more down in Dynasty 6, as if you move from Dynasty 3 to Dynasty 6 right away without 4 and 5, it makes sense, okay? So the sequence of evolution from 3, escaping 4 and 5 and going right away to 6, it will be a little bit convincing, okay? But to put 5 and especially 4, it will destroy that sequence. because you don't jump to the top and then you come down to the bottom again. Okay. And as we explain in our tours, that the old constructions are much better than the newer constructions in quality, in size, in precision. So how come this is not correct? Okay. Like in our modern technology, our computers now are much better than the computers 10 years ago, 50 years ago. But you don't see a computer 50 years ago is much better than the computers we are using nowadays. Okay. So this is the case. So as if there is a big question behind the story of the evolution of these buildings. And by the New Kingdom time, they stopped building pyramids. That's why when you say I found it a must to present the famous mainstream story, so people can understand what are the locations of these mistakes and of these points which don't make sense with common sense and with logic and science also.
Right. And you've hit on a lot in your book and on tours. Even what the mainstream calls the pre-dynastic era, which were the archaic, you know, really caveman type, we've found these precision crafted vessels and vases that look like they were literally machined or laser cut. And then we've got these pyramids. So we've got all these things that just, yeah, like you said, don't seem to add up when you look at the science, when you look at the evidence. I want to ask you about Elephantine Island. This is one of my favorite places to visit on our tours. It's so beautiful down in that part of Egypt as you're sailing on the Nile. And let me just real quick give a shameless plug for our Egypt tour coming up this May. It's going to be May 8th through the 19th, 2024, with Mohammed Ibrahim, Egyptologist, tour guide, and now author, leading us as our fearless leader. We're going to see 20 plus sites. We are going to have a private visit inside the Great Pyramid of Giza for about 2 hours, just our group. We get to explore every chamber and passageway. It is going to be the trip of a lifetime. And one of my favorite things to do is sail down the Nile and go towards Aswan and Luxor and see all these sites. There's so much to share about it that I don't have time for, but you can go to stargatevoyager.com/tours to see the detailed itinerary and to save your spot. Right now, you can get $200 off if you use code Egypt2024, all caps, Egypt2024. So we hope to see you there. It's going to be incredible, and I cannot wait. So, Mohammed, when we're on tour, I love sailing down the Nile. Nothing like it. And as you get further south on the map, it gets more beautiful. These giant granite boulders and palm trees everywhere. And then there you see it, Elephantine Island, this large granite island in the middle of the Nile. And you share how it was known by the ancients as the heart of Egypt, that it was the source of the Nile. And it's not necessarily talking about the water, but the energized waters coming from underneath the island. So the last two times we've been on tour and we've gone to this island, you share about the legends and oral traditions you've heard concerning the Ark of the Covenant possibly coming to Egypt, to this island in the middle of the Nile. And there's this dynastic Egyptian, you know, temple that's been built. But we got to go underneath this temple last time, and no photos or video were allowed, unfortunately. But it was mind-blowing to go underneath and see this ancient megalithic architecture. Can you tell us what you know about why you think the Ark of the Covenant might have been there?
When we talk about the Ark, we must mention this story that the Ark was taken out of Egypt by the Exodus, and it was landed in Jerusalem. And I think later the Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar, who led a huge campaign to Jerusalem, I think the target was to find the Ark, because the moment they found the Ark, the Babylonian army left Jerusalem. So They didn't want to invade Jerusalem. And later, it was a kind of a miracle that the ark was returned to the people of Jerusalem. And a way to protect the ark, or, as I strongly believe, to recharge the ark, it must be sent back to its homeland, and especially to Elephantine Island, because I strongly believe that the ark was made because the ark is not the only ark existed in ancient Egypt. There were many, many arks, thousands of them. Each one used to be located inside what we call it the Holy of Holies of every temple. And there are some few arks still in Egypt. Mystically, we call them shrines. Okay. The temple of the island of Elephantine Island is attributed, or this is the place for a famous knitter, the word knitter, which mistakenly explained as God, but it's force of nature, power of nature, for knitter Khnum. Khnum is the ram-headed human shape. Khnum is responsible for creation, creating the body and creating the spirit, the Ka. So this is something we shall not escape, that the main nature of this island is responsible for creation. That's why maybe the energy of the place is talking about this, is like, this is how I explain it. The energy of the place is as if it is the energy of creation. So the ark was sent to Elephantine Island, to the motherland. And then the story is talking about sending the ark again in another journey further south to Ethiopia, to Aksum, to a church there. And it is being protected by special guards in a secret place. I think this is a rumor. The ark is still in Elephantine Island. And that's why the entire island is covered with millions of mud bricks. Mud bricks are working as insulation material. So if there is any kind of activations or energies or even anything from the quartz, it will not be easy to measure or detect because of the mud bricks. Okay, so that's why I believe that the ark is in a secure place, protected, because if the ark there in a visible place or in a regular place, maybe some satellites can scan the area and they can find the ark. But because of the millions of mud bricks, they will not be able to find the ark.
And it's so interesting how when you're on this island, there's so many evidences of lost technology all over it. I mean, you've got the infamous giant box that's on the backside, almost like they don't want you to go back there and see it. And if you're watching this on YouTube or Spotify, I'm going to show some photos of what I'm talking about here. But this precision box, or some call it a shrine, rose granite, and the thing's almost in perfect condition. And you can see drill holes in its corners. And then even behind that is even the broken, more blackish green boxes. So it's like there was technology all over this island and a massive cataclysm that literally just cracked these massive boxes in half. But then you've got, again, the dynastic Egyptian temple. I'm blanking on what it's called, which is the featured thing they want you to see on the island. But again, underneath it, round circular stone in the cave underneath that temple.
Three stones. These are stones from the bedrock. So these are not constructed stones. That is the bedrock itself. And there is a space between these stones. And the space is what I call it, the cave.
But tell us about the strange magnetic anomaly that happened with those stones underneath.
Because as we explained earlier, the whole island originally is granite. Okay. And now you go in a deeper level. And these huge round blocks, but they are still connected with the bedrock. They are not separate, okay? So as if there are kind of beams of energy comes out from these brown blocks, hitting each other and reflecting, bouncing inside the cave. Okay. And I think it creates a kind of field of strong energy inside this cave.
One of my favorite places to visit in Egypt is the Serapeum. And this is the labyrinth where I believe it was in 1850, it was rediscovered. It was hidden underneath the sands of time. And this is where these 24, 25 massive black boxes that look like they were crafted with laser-like precision are hidden in these tunnels. And I believe each box approximately weighs about 70 tons. And then it has a lid of 30 tons. There's so much confusion about what these boxes were for. The mainstream narrative I'm always going to reference states that these were simply housing the remains of sacred bulls, although I don't believe any bulls were ever found inside them. Tell us about these black boxes in your theory, and then I might ask you a few more questions.
Okay. First, when we talk about the tunnel itself, it's a challenge to dig this without modern tools or advanced tools, because of the nature of limestone. If you're using manual tools, hammers and chisels, you will produce powder of limestone, and it is a kind of sticky material like cement. And the fact is, they use limestone powder in the cement industry. Okay. So imagine the poor workers are freezing the powder of limestone for hours. I think they will not survive for the end of the day. They will die because of cemented lungs. Okay. And when you look to the corridor or the tunnel, especially from the midway, it is perfect A-frame ceiling, like the modern subways we have, the subways tunnels. Okay. Yes, as you said, we have 23 boxes plus some empty rooms. So if these empty rooms still have the box in each one, we may have like 27. Okay. The average weight of each box or all of them between 50 and 70 ton, and the average weight of the lids separately between the box 50 to 70 and the lid 20 to 30 ton. Okay. By the way, there is one special box in a closed section. This is double weight. This is maybe 120 or 130 ton as one piece. The box was made from one piece of granite. That is a great challenge, because we talk about a huge block was cut from the quarry and was brought all the way from Aswan to Saqqara. We talk about almost 700 kilometers. But that is not the only challenge. The main challenge is the precise cut, the angles from the corners and the base. It is sharp 90 degrees. And when I say sharp 90 degrees, there is no joke about it. It is not 89.9 or not 90.1. It is sharp 90 degrees. And it goes all the way to the bottom, and the angle at the bottom, the vertical angle, and the straight and the smoothness of the interior of the box, and also the exterior. But as I say, all of them are not the same from outside, but all of them are the same from inside. So I will not say it's impossible for our technology nowadays to do it, but it will be big challenge for our technology to finish it and to make it in a proper way, like what we have in the Serapeum. And we are not talking about one or two or three, we are talking about 23. And by the way, this is not the only place with boxes like this, but this is the only place with that number of boxes. I may add to the story when we talk about the sacred pool, that the mainstream story, and maybe the ancient Egyptian story also is telling us that this was the place, the burial place for the sacred pool. If I agree with this opinion, I agree because I think they didn't mean real bull, because there was another thing the ancient Egyptian used to call it, the bull of the sky. Okay, this thing is the meteorites. So maybe they found meteorites falling from the sky, and meteorites are full of what? Full of iron and other materials, but it has a kind of magnetism. So maybe they put these meteorites inside the boxes, and that's why we call it the bull or the sacred bull. And maybe these meteorites were being used as part of the mechanism of the place.
Yeah, so much mystery surrounding these boxes. And again, regarding all of the granite and megalithics we see in Egypt, the big question, one of the million-dollar questions, is how would the dynastic Egyptians of 3000 BC crafted this to precision when the boxes or the pyramids, for example, are mostly made out of very hard material like rose granite, a 7 on the Mohs scale, when they had tools, according to the archaeological record, that were way softer, right? Like copper chisels, and they might have even had iron in some places, but the point is they were much softer tools. How can softer tools precision cut much harder material? It can't. It's like a butter knife trying to cut through a wooden log, correct?
No, exactly. And by the way, because sometimes you may see a video on YouTube or something like this, for a people try to show you that a copper saw with a corrosive material like sand can make a cut or a scratch. That is true. Theoretically, that is true. But if we try to do one, okay, as real project, then we will understand that this is not a good idea at all. And we have famous two experiments. One, we call it the Japanese pyramid in Egypt, and the second one, we call it Nova, N-O-V-A pyramid. They wanted to build a very small pyramid, like 16 meters high, using the same claimed techniques. And they failed. Both projects didn't finish the job properly. Okay, and they found that the techniques they claim is not working. Okay, so even if we talk about iron tools, okay, it is not the same thing. Because we are not talking about something was made in a good way or in a nice shape. No, we are talking about precision. We are talking about soft sides, super smoothed, straight cuts, 90 degrees angles. So these precisions will not be made by manual tools, either copper is impossible, of course, or iron tools, because we are talking about, as you said, rose granite. We are not talking about limestone or sandstone. Okay, it can be handled, which is still also a big problem. But it's still, okay, iron tool can do the job maybe, but we are talking about rose granite. It's a very, very big challenge for tools like this.
And regarding these boxes, one other note, if it was really just men down there chiseling these out with hammers, they would have died and suffocated from all the dust they were breathing. Mm-hmm. Number two, it would have been pitch black. And so because this is subterranean, they would have had to have, you know, torches or some kind of light source. And the fumes from that would have affected their health too. And then these things are so heavy at 100 tons. You would need an army. We're talking thousands of men to transport. Yet there's no way they could fit in the little enclosures that surround the boxes, right? And so you've got all these questions that point to this was here way earlier and it was found. Last question on the boxes. When we were there inside them last time, you stated how you thought, or you were theorizing that these boxes possibly housed meteorites. But in your book, you talk about how there was even liquid coming out of one of the boxes. Tell us about the liquid, and then tell us how you theorize that some event happened, and that's why they're just sitting there unfinished.
Yes, one of the boxes, they allow us to get close, okay, and we can walk around. I realized that the box is polished and very shiny. And sometimes when you take a picture with flash, it reflects the flash, the light. All of them are this way, but because this is the one we can get close. So I was looking very carefully to the surface, and I found that the bottom of the lid, because the lid is like sliding slowly outside the edge of the box, the bottom is looks like a dusty surface, but the side is polished. So I looked carefully, and I found that there's a kind of a stain, like a liquid drop or like water, leaking down from the side to the bottom and causing the same polished surface to this dusty bottom. So I started to track similar examples, and I reached the idea that after they finished the box, they cover the box with a kind of chemical material. I think is a way to maybe enhance the ability of the box, or to make it more maybe connected, or more giving the box like what I call it skin. Okay, and that's why the box is very polished and very shiny. After you finish the tour and you start leaving the tunnel, there is another exit. Okay, you don't need to go the same way back, but there is another exit on the left side, another branch, but it's not huge tunnel. In the middle of this new tunnel, there is an unfinished box. And the box, and behind the box, 3 or 4 meters behind the box, the lid of the box. But the box is unfinished, okay? So any story about trying to steal this box out of the Serapeum, because unfortunately the guards are telling this to the visitors, that this box one day was inside the room in a nearby location, and they wanted to take this box out. No, that is not true, because they will not try to take unfinished box. There are so many other beautiful books. Okay, so why this one? So this one was getting in. Okay, so what happened? And also, by the way, this is a very good example. You see the size. You can compare the between the size of the box and the size of the tunnel. When we come to this part, we cross between the box and the tunnel. Only one person can go through, not two together, just one. So we talk about maybe 60 centimeters between the box and the wall. And from the other side, it is very small space, maybe 10 or 20 centimeters. Okay, so I'm trying to say there is no space for this army of men who will push and drag the box. Okay, so my opinion that this box was being sent to the room at the end of the corridor, but the workers disappeared or died. Okay, so if we talk about the ancient advanced civilization, we talk about the time before 10,500 BC. That time, according to a book I had the chance to buy and read for Dr. Jean-Paul Lavalliette, the name of the book, Earth Under Fire, and it talks about this disaster from the sun happened 10,500 BC. It was electromagnetic waves followed by heat waves followed by sound waves. So it was like almost killed everything on Earth, and as if we had to survive again as human, plants, animals, and everything. So that's why this box is also unfinished work, similar to the unfinished obelisk at the quarry. I think the same story, that the workers were about to finish the unfinished obelisk, but they were killed by this disaster.
Well, Muhammad, this has been a great, great seeing you. I want to honor your time. I know you got a lot going on. I'm super excited to see you this May for our Egypt tour. I think this is our third tour in a row with you, and I cannot wait. Any last words about our upcoming tour and why people should consider joining us?
The style of the tours we do is completely different from anybody else, because we are not explaining Egypt for the audience for according to the mainstream or even from the alternative thinkers. No, we try to tell the people the story and what are the evidence, and we give them the chance. We teach them how to see Egypt, how to see the sites, and also the level of quality we present is completely different. We are very keen on all the details, okay? But the most important thing we do is the true message, or the true that our mission is to give you the best experience ever, okay? Because we know you will took for the people who participate in the tour. We know that you paid money, you took a vacation. From your job, you leave your family, you leave your country. So we appreciate this. And that's why we try to give you the best experience ever, with the best food, the best transportation. And that's why I will share with you some good news. This is now exclusive, that we upgraded the hotel in Cairo. I don't remember, because my office is doing this. These are the first stay or the second stay to Mina House Hotel. So wow. We are going to enjoy the location of the Mina House, which is very close to Giza Pyramids, and the high quality service of Mina House. So this is a great opportunity. Don't hesitate and book the tour with us.
Yeah, when Mohammed says Mina House, this is the most incredible hotel in Giza, looking right at the Great Pyramids. It's like a paradise inside this place. We got to stay there the last two nights, I think, on our last tour, and we were I've been itching to get back. So I cannot wait for our Egypt tour 2024 this May 8th. And you can go to StargateVoyager.com/tours to see all the info, to see the detailed itinerary. And you can also hit a button if you want to message me and ask any further questions. But Mohammed, thank you again for your time, and I cannot wait to see you in May, my friend.
Thank you, Derek, and me too. I can't wait to start this tour with you.
Congratulations also on your book, and I just hope that it opens and awakens many minds.
Thank you very much. And this is what we do every year, and I can see that we are doing this 5th, 6th, maybe 15 times.
I hope so. Thanks again.